The Guardian. This is The Reckoning, Part 2. Last time, we took the road to the Australian Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse. Now, we're there. Listening to the appalling truths it uncovered. Warning, the material in The Reckoning is explicit and tough.
Prior to meeting Ridsdale, I was doing really well. And when he came along, the situation in my life changed dramatically. I bottled up for years afterwards. The abuse has impacted my relationships, my kids. They've had a hard time. They have seen me at my best and my worst. Recent car accident meant I had to give up work. This has triggered more trauma, and it has been hard not having work to keep me busy. To this day, Ridsdale still haunts me.
15,000 people brought their stories to the Royal Commission. Paul Levy was one of them. The Commission sat all over Australia, but ground zero for child abuse was the city of Ballarat in Victoria. And Melissa Davey, my colleague at Guardian Australia, went up to Ballarat for the hearings.
I remember driving up to the courtroom where the Ballarat hearings were being held. And before I even could see the court, there were cars honking, like horns honking. And as I got closer, I could see it was because there were dozens of abuse survivors and advocates standing outside. And, you know, these signs emblazoned with slogans about pedophiles and abusers. Ballarat is a town that is seeped in this history of abuse. People who live there are aware of it. They know what went on. And so to see those survivors standing there outside the court with their signs and their placards, and to see the people of Ballarat driving past supporting them, it was just so profound. And then, you know, it's different when you're there in the room, because the support that they give each other as they get up there and they tell their stories, sometimes publicly for the first time, the tears, the people who need to leave the room because they can't bear to hear another word, survivors leaning on each other, unable to walk because they're just so shaken by what they've just heard. And that is where I met Paul Levy for the first time. And that's where I heard his story for the first time. One of the most powerful pieces of evidence, I think, that I heard throughout the Commission's hearings.
The worst pedophile in Australia, the most determined, predatory and protected pedophile, Father Gerald Ridsdale, operated for 30 years in the Ballarat Diocese.
The first complaint that ever came in was in my first year as a priest, and that would have been Ballarat North. Then later the bishop called me in and said there had been a complaint. And he said, if this thing happens again, then you are off to the missions.
Ridsdale looked an abject figure on the screen, beamed in from his prison. But he was once an engaging, lively man. And as he grew older and put on a bit of weight, he grew a beard and he called himself Fuzzy Bear and he asked kids to give him a hug. We know that Father Jerry, as they called him, abused hundreds of kids. He will die in jail. Fresh charges are still being laid. He charmed his way into families, families that were tremendously impressed that a priest would come to lunch.
I met Gerald Ridsdale in 1980 when I was 12 years old. Ridsdale was studying at the National Pastoral Institute in Elsternwick at the time. He was introduced to us through a friend of my mother's who was a nun, Sister Genevieve.
Sometime in 1980, Sister Genevieve gave me a ring and asked if Paul and I would like to go on a trip to the opal fields at White Cliffs.
My mother and I went to White Cliffs and camped there for about 2 weeks. This was in early 1980. I remember that some of Ridsdale's relatives, including nephews, were also there. This was the first time I'd ever spent any time with Ridsdale.
Paul's mother, Anne Levy, was born into what she calls a strict Irish Catholic family. She was brought up to respect the church and priests deeply. Her mother was a housekeeper to priests. She went to church every Sunday of her life, until recently.
Jerry spent a lot of time with Paul on the trip, but I never thought anything as sinister was happening.
Ridsdale sexually abused me on this trip by masturbating me and forcing me to touch him.
He would turn up on a Saturday morning, sometimes wearing his football club's beanie, and he would sit with the father of the family, having a beer, watching the game. There'd be a meal, a family meal. The family is honoured to have the priest at the meal. He'd say grace, of course, before the meal began, and then after the meal, he would take one of the sons fishing and abuse him.
Jerry became a family friend. He often visited the family home, usually on a weekly basis, and pick Paul up from school every now and then. Jerry would take him on different outings, including to the pictures and the zoo. Paul also occasionally stayed overnight with Jerry at National Pastoral Institute on weekends.
He had a little self-contained unit there. Each time Ridsdale asked my parents if I could stay with him, he'd pick me up from school on Friday afternoons. He would abuse me there by way of oral sex and masturbation.
My husband and I separated in March 1980. At this time, Paul was misbehaving and not attending school.
Ridsdale would often come and stay at our house for the weekend. He got more involved in trying to help the family.
Throughout this time, Jerry continued to see Paul and used to take him away on the weekends, including another trip to White Cliffs. I thought it was great that Paul was spending time with Jerry since his father was not around.
By this time, Ridsdale had been a priest for 20 years, being moved from parish to parish. The pattern was always the same. Abuse, discovery, being withdrawn from the parish. Sometimes he was sent for treatment and then always back into another parish. These people knew what Ridsdale was doing. The local priests knew what Ridsdale was doing, and the bishops of Ballarat knew, not least because he told them.
I was later to find out that the local doctor in Mortlake knew, the police in Mortlake knew that he was offended with other children, and nothing was done, nothing was actually followed up, you know, and that was in Mortlake. You know, everybody in Mortlake knew that Ridsdale was offending.
And in 1982, this little boy was allowed to live alone in the presbytery with Ridsdale, sleeping on a stretcher beside Ridsdale's bed. And it was known that he was there. It was known. It was not a secret. This appalling pedophile had a child in his bedroom, and nothing was done.
I had no real say in that. I went to school at the Catholic Regional College in Noorat. I lived with Ridsdale from Easter to about October 1982. I was sexually abused all the time, just about every day. I had my own bedroom in the presbytery, but that was the front. I always slept in Ridsdale's room where there was two beds and no one else lived in the presbytery.
Paul was in hospital after a trampoline accident and Jerry came to visit him. Paul said to me, "Mum, I don't like him touching me." I had seen Jerry touch Paul on the hand. I went to the nurse's station and said that Jerry wasn't allowed to visit Paul again. I didn't think much of it, although I noticed Paul was clearly uncomfortable.
No one ever said, why were you down in the milk shed on your own with that kid, you know what I mean? Or, you know, things like that. It was just like, he's a priest. Whatever was going on, you know, whatever they were doing is okay because he was a priest.
It was not until 1990 when I saw vision of Jerry on television and an interview with Paul on 7:30 Report saying he was pressing charges against Jerry that everything came together. I was devastated and angry and upset and still cannot believe this was done to Paul. Was done to Paul by someone who everybody respected. Paul and I didn't speak for about three years after this. Our family was broken because of what had happened. It has been hell to live with the knowledge that Paul was abused by Jerry. I continue to feel guilty and blame myself and not for not having my eyes open at the time of the abuse.
Thank you, Mrs. Levy.
Mum has swung around completely. She stopped going to church. She couldn't believe what they were saying in the Royal Commission, what the hierarchy of the church were actually saying and lying. And she said, you know, she said they're lying, Paul, and how can I go to church when these bishops are going into a courtroom and lying?
Over the last couple of years, the commission has been handing down findings along the way, findings into the Boy Scouts, into YMCA, into the Salvation Army. It's a long, long list. Into the Christian Brothers, into the Marist Brothers, into the Catholic Diocese of Wollongong, into Swimming Australia. But the most scorching of those findings was the Commission's verdict on Ballarat. It tore the reputation of the now very old and frail Bishop Mulkerns to shreds. He was said to have shown extraordinary and inexcusable failures. His conduct was declared to be appalling. The Ballarat report was handed down in the middle of December 2017, a couple of days before the commissioners and their staff reassembled in the headquarters in Sydney CBD and sat for the last time.
All right, on the count of three.
When you walked up to the court, there was a sea of survivors and advocates who had shown up from all around Australia for this final hearing.
I came from Campbelltown. There's some Victorians here.
It was a short hearing, it was a symbolic hearing, purely held to mark the end of the Royal Commission's work, but they wanted to be there. And they came from regional towns.
Someone from Cairns.
And Western Australia, and I'm from Enmore in Sydney.
Major cities, rural towns.
I'm from Menai.
To see the Royal Commission and Justice McClellan sit for one final time.
I'm Brian from Frankston in Victoria.
They carried signs that said, "Thank you, Royal Commission."
Because I'm part of it.
Everyone has a story about what happened and how it happened, so...
Did you tell your story through a private session or a public hearing? Private session.
Yep. It was relatively stressful. I ended up in hospital about a day and a half later.
Upon reflecting on it, are you glad you spoke and did it?
So it's what you're trying to describe is a fairly black and white thing. So when people ask, you know, is it good, is it bad? What I say is it's like a box of chocolates with stones in it.
My name's John Lawrence. I'm from Cockatoo in Victoria. I've been into the Royal Commission myself. I've told my story, which is pretty upsetting, which is pretty emotional, and really pretty traumatic after, say, 50 years of being out of a boy's home. And I think it's probably the fact that when you get out of the place, the story goes on. You have to live your life. And some people live their life by themselves. They've got no one. Some people don't make it. They commit suicide when they leave. I probably tried that myself. I don't like admitting that. It's unfortunate, but that's what happens when you're put under trauma and stress and you were sexually abused. And I'm here also to support the people that aren't here, that have died. Like my brother died, and what he saw in there is why he died.
Any politician who attended, Bill Shorten, Malcolm Turnbull, Jenny Macklin, they got a Royal Commission badge pinned to their chests by the survivors and the advocates.
The first thing I want to say is we love you and we believe you. I said that to you in 2009. I say that to you again. I said that to you again.
And this was all going on outside the court. And then inside the building, about 200 survivors and advocates came and sat waiting for Justice McClellan to deliver his final speech.
In all, more than 15,000 people who we have confirmed to be within our terms of reference have contacted the Royal Commission. Just over 8,000 people have come and spoken with a commissioner in a private session. For many of those people, it has been the first time they have told their story. Most have never been to the police or any person in authority to report the abuse.
And you know, a lot of the survivors of abuse are in their 70s, 80s, 90s now. And so throughout the room, there were blankets that the commission staff had placed on chairs for people who might be cold. There were tissue boxes at the end of every aisle. They cried, they held each other's hands, and you just got a sense that it was just such an important moment for them to be able to sit there and to hear from McClellan that their stories meant a lot to him, that their stories meant a lot to the other commissioners, and that their stories would help to inform change. And that is what it was all about to so many of them.
The Commission's work is done. There are 17 volumes of final report for the country to pore over. But it's not over. It's not over for the victims. It never will be. It's not over for the politicians who now have the responsibility to make sure this never happens again. Next on The Reckoning, is this really, as Julia Gillard claimed when the commission was set up, is it really going to change Australia? If this podcast has raised any issues for you, you can find support at childabuseroyalcommission.gov.au/contact. I'm David Marr, and The Reckoning is produced for Guardian Australia by Miles Martignoni and Melissa Davey.